I've always claimed that places are stronger than people, the fixed scene stronger than the transitory succession of events. This is the theoretical basis not of my architecture, but of architecture itself. In substance, it is one possibility of living. I liken this idea to the theatre. People are like actors. When the footlights go up, they become involved in an event with which they are probably unfamiliar, and ultimately, they will always be so. The lights, the music, are no different from a fleeting summer thunderstorm, a passing conversation, a face. But at other times the theatre is closed, and cities like vast theatres sometimes are empty. While it may be touching that everyone acts out his little part, in the end, neither the mediocre actor nor the sublime actress is able to alter the course of events. You're listening to a podcast about buildings and cities. I am Luke Jones.
And I'm George Ginchell. Last time, we discussed Aldo Rossi's major written work, The Architecture of the City. But as well as being an academic writer, he was also a prolific, successful and highly influential architect between the early 60s and his untimely death in a car accident in 1997. In this episode, we're going to look at a selection of his work, its themes, key ideas, developments and influence. In his early career, he was a radical outsider who placed himself in stark opposition to the functionalist architecture of the mainstream, exploring a new kind of formalism, a geometry of triangles, circles, cones, and a renewed historicism, connected to an interest in type. In his late career, he was an architectural superstar, the representative of a strain of architectural interest in the image of a deep cultural memory, embedded in the centres of architectural thought in the 1980s, and synonymous with a particular, moody, austere aesthetic within the wider postmodern cultural movement.
Aldo Rossi's first built project, which was constructed in 1965, is a monument to the partisans, the wartime resistors of German occupation and Italian fascism, built in Segrate, which is an eastern suburb of Milan. It's an urban project. It's normally identified as the monument only, but in fact it also involved the redesign of the square. It's somewhere between a tiny building and a sort of largish sculpture. Present in it are a whole series of geometrical forms which we're going to see reoccurring pretty much throughout Aldo Rossi's career. The equilateral triangle, the cone, sort of narrow spaces between tall parallel walls, flat piers.
The fat column.
The fat column, yeah.
The really fat column.
The monument is cast in concrete, and it appears from one end a little bit like a child's drawing of a house, rather distended and over tall. When you walk around the side, you would then see that the roof part has been shifted, as it were, by halfway down its length, so as to create an overhanging triangular pipe, out of the end of which cascades a constant stream of water. It has a resonance with certain historic antecedents, the strange and not very well understood Etruscan tombs.
The main thing it shares actually with the strange Etruscan tombs, when we were writing this I thought it was very connected to, and I now think it's less connected to. I think it's coincidence, because they are a subversion, the Etruscan tombs are a subversion of the type of the house. So they are like a weird, distorted version of the houses that the people lived in when they were alive, with ornaments and furniture and all sorts of things. And this is also a distorted type of a house. It's like a drawing of a house that's been pulled apart and subverted and sort of made jokey, but in a very serious way. And it's that relationship of, like, this is the house for the... He's always, as we saw in the podcast on the architecture of the city, mournful, nostalgic. The monument to the partisans, which actually I think could have been something completely different, because it's not a monument to the, you know, dead of... It's a monument to the partisans. They sort of won, sort of. Yeah. You know, they, like, Mussolini did end up upside down dead at a petrol station. So it didn't need to be like that, but actually it's like this broken down type of a house for the dead.
Yeah, it's stark, empty. Its abstraction is somehow threatening.
Even the geometries have been broken down to the most primal. All the shapes are really primal. It's like a large sculpture. It dominates. Its scale is much bigger than that of a human. It's like a dominant single object. It's got bigness, even though it's quite small. It's monolithic, is strange, and it's in the middle of a courtyard, which is otherwise empty. Putting things in the middle of a courtyard, by the way, is an interesting act, because it, especially if it's a monument, it suddenly means the courtyard, which could have been about people congregating in the middle, has a relationship to the object. Which I guess is, with reference to your starting position, sort of what he's about. It's less about the, like, human events of the square than this mournful monument to the dead.
And in an interesting way, we already have this mirroring of the themes that we were talking about in the architecture of the city, in the sense that we have, like, almost the smallest possible imaginable piece of architecture inside an urban space, which is inside a suburb of the city, which is defined by its relation to the larger city. And we're already starting to get this very Rossian idea that the whole, you know, the part, however small, is always a representation of the whole. That even in some way, even this monument is also a city.
Yeah, and it's within a city, which is part of a city. I mean, in a very literal sense. And it's extremely an urban artifact. And it also aspires to be a monument in his own terms. And also I think we should probably go more into type or typology or whatever, yeah, and sort of talk about that. It's a very loose word. It just means putting things into categories. A category could be houses, or it could even be buildings to live in. Yeah. And then it could have a subcategory of flats or deck access housing, yeah, or
houses with one window, houses with two windows.
Yeah, yeah. But or anything else as well. It could be, it just almost means a category, but it kind of gets rolled up with this sort of notion of like an archetype, like the archetypical house or the archetypical English country house or a palazzo or a Gothic townhouse. That's the sort of established meaning.
It becomes freighted with a sort of historical identification and also a symbolic one. And those two are mutually reinforcing. So it becomes, you know, yes, as you say, the Gothic house or the apartment, the rent barracks apartment, or like any of these things, they become identified with a certain established historical phenomenon which has a duration. And then these things also become linked to a sort of symbolic idea that this is what a home looks like. Like, yeah, that a home, you know, a thing which is in some way essentially connected to the human condition, also has a certain abstract form. It becomes an archetype, which I would say is an archetype is kind of like, it's sort of platonic.
Oh, wow, it's a kind of expanding all terms. That
it's a kind of it's like Platonism for architects, yeah, isn't it? Yeah,
it just means master type originally. And then becomes like this idea that somewhere deep in the human soul, the collective human soul, are these things that are like universal, yeah, to a culture.
And as we're going to see, Rossi is definitely susceptible to this way of thinking, which I find, yeah, quite bogus, but there you go. Well,
yeah, it's bogus, but it's attractive.
Yeah, it's super attractive, and it, because everything becomes like dreamlike and lovely, and you know,
it also makes you feel like you're doing something magical. It's quite sort of Dungeons and Dragons. You're like, I'm getting in touch with the deep. I'm not like these people designing post-war parsonages. I'm getting in touch with the deep psyche of mankind.
One of the things to say about Aldo Rossi's early projects is that, in a way, we could be talking about juvenilia. If we were talking about the early projects of, you know, like Le Corbusier or, yeah, Mies van der Rohe or Edwin Lutyens or whatever, these architects, as for their first three or four projects, produce things which really are not at all typical of what they would go on to become. But in Aldo Rossi's case, the early projects are absolutely like readable as part of a continuum which all of the other projects are part of. And in many ways, you could probably drop them into mid-career somewhere and you might be deceived.
Actually,
I think
it might be slightly worse than that. I think it's like someone who does films, and his first film is brilliant, and then each successive film is a slightly more watered down version of what he was doing at the beginning, to the point where they become a bit like, and it might be like Woody Allen or something, where like even in the late career, like there's the odd pretty good one, but fundamentally, that if it was just the late career, it's not why you're interested. You're interested because you want another thing from the great man.
There are these two mass housing projects in which Rossi
there's a key difference between them, one of which is that one of them was built and one of them wasn't built.
So the unbuilt one in Monza is a collaboration with Giorgio Grassi, and it's an austere development of slab blocks forming these two kind of grids of smallish square courtyards. And it's as if you had, this sort of big arrangement of about 12 little courtyards, which has been broken in the middle, and then the two halves in a quite ragged way, and the two halves set slightly at an angle to each other. And the project is unbuilt, but it's obviously very influential both on other architects and also on Rossi himself. It keeps cropping up in his later drawings. It's one of the motifs of his very famous collages, which he keeps making and selling all the way through the 80s.
A number of things to say about this. One of which, to a sort of formalist, it's very exciting, isn't it? I mean, you can kind of take the piss out of formalism, but, oh, I'm going to set up an order, which is a grid. That's exciting. It's this, like, grid building, really strong, really stark. And then I'm going to have it fray, so it sort of peters out into lines. And then I'm going to have the intervention of the natural world. Is it like a road or a river or something?
Yeah, it's partly...
Like a stream or something?
Yeah, but there's also a kind of a road geometry which it's responding to as well a little bit, I think.
Which means that there's another bit which is at a slight angle, which sets up this tension between, you know, two grids at slight angles to each other. And also... to him as a... I mean, I guess what I'm trying to get at is why this seemingly quite calm thing is so sort of... It's also that it's playing into historic types, right? It's this making the slab block into a courtyard house and into a square, because there's two different sizes of square, one of which feels more like a block, a city block, and one of which feels more like an urban square.
But they're both, in both cases, it's an extremely classical or neoclassical gesture, really. They're these very square, very rational blocks. I haven't ever seen any pictures of what the actual sort of fenestration or facade design is like.
I don't think they're really bothered with any of that stuff.
But it's extremely neoclassical in a way which I think is a sort of a little bit of a rhetorical break with... modernism, really.
It's that high modernist neoclassicism, isn't it? It's that. And it's not surprising. We spoke last time about where he grew up. These are like the most... If you want a model for a city that is unbelievably beautiful and attractive and interesting and dynamic, you know, the places where he's publishing these books... The Architect of the City was published in Padua.
So it's... The historicism is already there.
They are much starker and sparser. His works are always, they're always monumental.
But then normally there's a play of these different, a sort of theatrical play of different elements. And in the case of both of these projects, they are like big white things, which are extremely austere. And it gives them one of the transitions which occurs during the move from the early work to the later work is the creeping in of colour and sort of whimsy.
He does have a notion that there are buildings which are monuments and there are buildings which are background. The two housing blocks are like bits of city made of background. Like the gestures are public gestures and the buildings themselves are less important than the gestures, than the sort of public spaces.
They don't call huge attention to themselves except through the severity of the kind of rationalism.
And through the nature and character of the open spaces, the public spaces, the assemblage. I would sort of have a thesis that his architecture becomes less and less about the urban assemblage. And I think it starts off very strongly like that.
This idea of the two offset grids is not a thing which Rossi does again, but it's a thing which Peter Eisenman will then take up and, basically do about 10 projects on during the 1980s. So it was obviously a sort of fruitful idea, but it's not... Curiously, it's not one that appealed to Rossi that much. The other housing project is at Galaratese, which is, I think, another suburb of Milan. It's a collaboration with Carlo Aimonino.
Carlo Aimonino,
who... It was in progress for much of the 60s. It completed in about 1970. The whole thing is like a new... It's like a new suburb, the whole area. And they were building housing there pretty much from the end of the war up until the 80s. it's part of a particular part of the complex, most of which is built by Imanino, and one block of which is designed by Rossi as a sort of guest insertion. Imanino's blocks are huge, high-density, sort of mega-structural brick blocks with a complex section and split-level flats. Rossi designed one block which radiates out of this slightly complex assemblage at the point where they come together, one of a number of different urban, supposedly urban elements implanted into the landscape. There are some sort of ersatz squares, something that looks like an amphitheatre, but it absolutely sticks out. It's completely different from any of them.
Yeah, so the things that aren't Rossi's are actually quite, they're sort of like fruity late modernist or almost brutalist. If by that you get out of your idea, the idea of concrete, and sort of think
sort
about
sort of brick brutalist. The mass is very much sort of broken up, and the section is very kind of offset and divided.
Yeah, yeah, it's all clever. And basically, this was a quite late development and a more prestigious one. The rest of the suburb is mainly horrible tower blocks, sandwiched between two arterial roads. Which actually have got like the beautiful neoclassical graveyard on one side and the like horse racing track on the other. So it's this very strange, completely artificial and actually I think fairly horrible suburb.
Apologies
to anyone who happens to live there.
Galeratesi's dwellers. Send us an email.
And it is this very strange. So there's this landscape of like randomly placed, seemingly arbitrarily placed, like big tower blocks, all oblongs. And this thing which is like a sort of fan of tower blocks.
Yeah, or sort of
slab blocks, sorry. Yeah. And one of which, all of which are brick except for this one which is like light grey.
Yeah. So,
very minimal.
Rossi's is... It's like a very minimal, relatively low-level cuboid, which is extremely long. It has, I think, four stories.
But two of them are almost completely empty.
Yes, the bottom two are most, for most of its length, are a very stark colonnade. And the upper two levels are flats. And it's a little bit different down its length. What the things which are remarkable about it are its continuous length with very little modulation in its overall form. It's basically this sort of extruded rectangle all the way down. The colonnade isn't totally all the way down. It snakes through slightly, but it's
completely consistent on one side where it is uniform, and the other side it's sort of half in, half out in a uniform pattern, I think, which it repeats three times. So it's a colonnade down one end with these piers, thin concrete piers, which are very deep.
Yeah. So within the colonnade, the columns, as they were, these piers present as these quite wide, flat things. And then from the outside looking into the colonnade, they present as these quite fine, thin things. So they're sort of rectangular in plan.
Yeah. And they block the view from most angles. Their depth is something like, I think it's more than the gap between them. If you look down it, you can't see the outside world, but you can see the play of light on all these grey concrete surfaces. And it's also very large. I mean, it's a generous double height space. There's almost more colonnade in this housing block than flats. Like, jolly, you know, and that's, I think the only way it could be built was with these very dense blocks around it.
It's a peculiar gesture in lots of ways. In terms of a historical precedent, these things are all over the cities of northern Italy, these sort of colonnades and arcades which line the streets, but they're not like this. Their columns are kind of nice little columns which you can see through and around and dance about.
And they're very much about being almost the street, 80% the street.
This one creates this strange sort of hermetic space separated from what's outside of it. It's also peculiar because its scale is so much in tension with its location. This is the scale of a really major sort of urban building on a really major urban space, but it's in a suburb.
It's a loggia between nowhere and nowhere, with nowhere at either end. Yeah. Like, it's sort of a sort of car park on the other side, and the other side of it is sort of a little bit of something, and then there's another block, a little bit of scrub.
Yeah, no, it kind of collides with, like, hedges and trees and things.
If there's nothing around it, essentially. There's nothing. It's not mediating anything, this colonnade. It's just about creating this space which the sort of Antonioni, nostalgic, atomized man could walk away from the camera in.
Oh, yeah. Yes, and sort of dance in and out of the columns, appearing at, like, 20-second intervals.
Yeah, like the long shot with mainly no one.
Yeah, that'd be great.
It's that sort of, like, it's the space in which, you know, you can feel everything is so empty, you can feel the very big emotions.
Yes, well, you like, can you become aware of the, not that you become aware of these significant feelings, but you become aware of their absence. So this is very much the white period. We could talk about another building from this period, which is his school in Fagnano Olona. The sort of pivot or sort of point of inflection that we're coming to is A, the architecture of the city, and B, the construction of the cemetery at Modena, which is the big project which is going to change everything. But let's do one more. So while we're still in the white period, we can do the school, which is it a primary school?
It's a primary school. Yeah. That one's a primary school, and the square one is a middle school.
It's this rigorously symmetrical plan with these kind of radiating wings. It has,
like, a sort of figure or something. Yeah. You know, all these blocks like arms in rectangles.
And they're all kind of low. Are they single story?
Can we just, like, mention where it is?
Yeah.
Like, because it's, if you've been around northern Italy, it's in, like, the outer fringes, the sort of detached post-war house with terracotta roofland.
Yeah. So everything is kind of coloured render.
Yeah, everything's coloured render. All the buildings have got big gardens around them. And it's another object like that in this. And I think him trying to take on the urban condition of sort of outer suburbia is an interesting challenge. He does, one thing he consistently does is try and take on the not cool, the strange, like, actual urban conditions that you meet that aren't just the beautiful town squares. And this is sort of trying to be, like, from the outside, it's sort of being another one of these funny objects.
Yeah, it's more or less on a single story, isn't it?
That there are two buildings which are two stories, and the rest of it is all one story.
Yeah,
and it's in a very low density place.
And it's these little white render sort of rectangular volumes which are pieced together in a sort of symmetrical assemblage. Yeah. Apart from the one standout element, which is the library, which is
a cylinder with a cone roof, which is in the middle, and it's got very few windows, very few apertures. So it's like this big cylinder. And the other thing about the site, as well as being a suburbia, is it's on a slightly picturesque post-industrial site. There's a big old chimney which was restored, and it's sort of the beginning of him.
He fell in love when he saw this chimney in some way.
Yes. He really loves things like grain silos, these blank, you know, I can imagine him really going for, like, grain elevators as well. Like, the industrial shape, but only the really primary forms, not the sort of Becker, like, lots of, he doesn't like all this, like, lots of winches and things. He likes the sort of just the primary form as a heavy thing. And it's another one of these places which is definitely to be viewed empty. I haven't seen a single picture with a single child in this school, or anybody. There are quite a lot of pictures of it, even contemporary pictures, and quite clearly everybody's waited for everybody to go home.
In its plan, this symmetrical assemblage of primary forms, circles, squares and rectangles, it's strongly kind of reminiscent of Claude-Nicolas Ledoux's design for the salt works at Chaux, which is this neoclassical piece of paper architecture, but which has this big effect on lots of 20th century architects,
it's actually extremely formalist. The strange thing is they're having a circle in it. But then again, even a lot of the formalists will play with circles and squares.
I think there's a play of the elements, and there's also a way of... They do two things. They play with these primary forms, but they also use them to create, in the plan, a kind of diagram of hierarchy.
It's a sort of circuit diagram of, like, these are this is this, and you can read it very clearly.
So that the separate most important elements are something special, like a triangle or a circle. And they're tied together with rectangles.
And it's all very small as well. It's not. This is a little primary school. like so often, his attempts to deal with the urban setting of these funny ex-urban, they generally don't really work, because it sort of becomes this lost object, like all the other lost objects.
Yeah,
and I think that might be part of the one of the causes that causes him to step away from doing that.
Yeah, well, I think they become inevitably these sort of isolates, these like gestures towards a kind of intense urbanity, but which are then amputated or isolated and kind of floating in green desert. In 1966, he released The Architecture of the City, which we talked about on the last programme. And in 1971, he began work on really his most famous project, I think still his most famous project, and the one which is the kind of crux around which the sort of narrative of his career revolves. In his scientific autobiography, Rossi recalls this car accident he had on a trip through Yugoslavia in 1971. Which I think
very bad driver.
I think he honestly
like lots of car crashes.
He had I think sort of two or three serious car crashes. Yeah,
three.
Yeah, including the one which killed him. just do a bit of victim blaming is very much en vogue today, so we're going to do a bit of that. I think it was quite a bad wreck, and in the stay in hospital which followed, where he couldn't move for a while, he talked about this experience of being constrained and unable to move as the origin of his design for the extension to the cemetery of San Cataldo at Modena. In April of 1971, on the road to Istanbul between Belgrade and Zagreb, I was involved in a serious auto accident. Perhaps as a result of this incident, the project for the cemetery at Modena was born in the little hospital of Slavonski Brod, and simultaneously my youth reached its end. I lay in a small ground floor room near a window through which I looked at the sky and little garden. Lying nearly immobile, I thought of the past, but sometimes I did not think. I merely gazed at the trees and the sky. This presence of things, and of my separation from things, bound up also with the painful awareness of my own bones, brought me back to my childhood. During the following summer, in my study for the project, perhaps only this image and the pain in my bones remained with me. I saw the skeletal structure of the body as a series of fractures to be reassembled. At Slavonski Brod, I had identified death with the morphology of the skeleton and the alterations it could undergo. I now realise, however, that to regard death as a kind of fracture is a one-sided interpretation.
Just to mention the scientific autobiography.
Yeah.
It's another one of these books which is a bit all like that all the way through. It doesn't make, there's no through line. It doesn't make very much sense.
In theory, it's a narrow, it's, well, in theory, it's an autobiography, and it's an autobiography focusing on his formation and his projects.
Yeah, but and it's a sort of discursive, rambling,
it's
poetic.
Meant to talk about them in order.
Yeah.
Which it sort of does, but actually it skips out a lot of them, and it's very much about what he was interested in at the time.
It's discursive and tendentious, and poetic, and probably lovely in small quantities.
Yeah.
It's probably a good, like, probably a good toilet book. You can kind of have your, like, moment of revelation and then put it down. Little bits of it. Do you want some more brandy? Oh, well, the separation's sort of obvious. The separation. Oh, I think it's quite straightforwardly that he has... Like, I broke my arm recently, and I can tell you a little bit about this. It wasn't a car crash, but it was kind of similar. And suddenly you're, like, stuck in a room for a long time, and you are forced to almost meditate on the condition of your life. And you are taken out of... this is something I really experienced, actually. It was a significant phenomenon. Slightly irritatingly, my mother told me it would happen, which is that you're forced to come out of your life and you evaluate everything that's going on, and you sort of resolve. It gives you the distance to resolve, to put yourself away from your emotions, and everything's going on in the world, and they're very present in yourself. Like, you are aware of all of these things being very close to you, and you'll return to them, but you're separated from them, and it gives you a lot of perspective. You definitely are able to have this distance. You feel very involved in your life, and you have this ability to distantly evaluate things while you're not in the like frenetic moment. I don't understand the skeleton. I mean, I understand the phenomenon of becoming much more aware of your body when you get hurt, your corporeal mortality, or your just your embodiment as a sort of machine becomes evident. And to a certain sort of person, I think that could lead you to think about the extent and edge of the body within a physical world.
I think some of this might make more sense when we talk about the building. I think that the idea that... I think he's struck by a certain kind of poetry about the bones sort of healing and reassembling themselves, which maybe speaks to this deeper historical idea he has about sort of permanence and endurance and the reappearance or repetition of things already established.
Also, I think the notion of the fracture... death is the ceasing of ongoing process, maybe. And so, in a way, death is a form of incompleteness. It's like a process that will never complete itself. Because you can think of it as obviously a completion, but you can also think of it as the end of the process, which is going towards completion.
Let me just do a little quote from the competition text. He talks about, he says... The cemetery, when considered in terms of a building, is the house of the dead. Initially, no distinction was made between the typology of the house and that of the tomb. The typology of the tomb and of the sepulchral structures overlapped the typology of the house, rectilinear corridors, a central space, earth and stone materials. Death expressed a state of transition between two conditions, the borders of which were not clearly defined. The urns, shaped like Etruscan houses, and the Roman baker's tomb express the everlasting relationship between the deserted house and the abandoned work. Consequently, references to the cemetery are applicable to the cemetery itself, as well as to the house and to the city. Yeah, well, some of this we've already alluded to. So that he talks about this, the fact that early tombs are like houses.
The baker's tomb he's talking about, I think, the only one I can think of, is the baker's tomb in Rome, which is mid-imperial, and is made of all of these, like, giant cylinders, which are sort of maybe, like, grain-measuring cylinders. It's this really strange object, which I can imagine he would love. It's, like, monumental, ambiguous, made of these strange cylinders, which have supposedly got some relationship to the baking, and then, like, there's a picture of the person who died in it.
The first thing to say about the project is that it's an extension.
It's a sort of doubling in size of an already large and grand.
Yeah, large and very striking cemetery outside of Modena, which is a sort of smallish city to the south of Verona. And it's the... So there's a 19th century cemetery. It's like this huge, big, colonnaded courtyard. The sort of walls of the colonnade behind the sort of colonnade space are... full of dead people, and in the Italian tradition they're full of like actual bodies
in sort of filing cabinets.
Yeah, you put people in a kind of a drawer so that they're ready to like burst out when the trumpet sounds.
You only rent space, I think. So there's a sort of classic big graveyard in the square which has got sort of streets running through it, and on those streets are little building like house like mausolea, which are like either little chapels or mausoleums, you know, little houses of the dead. There are these beautiful colonnades full of these great big mobile step ladders, actually, which you can sort of climb up
to polish up
Granny and give her flowers.
So the new one is essentially a doubling in size, and it has this sort of outer colonnaded form, but rather than the inside being filled in a slightly ad hoc way with these different mausolea, it has a whole series of structures which are designed for it. There is a big cube, which is a repository for cremated remains.
Big red cube.
Well, in the competition, this is why it's a sort of point of change. In the competition, everything was going to be grey. But by the time it gets to be built, actually it ends up as this sort of red, beige play of different coloured renders.
Which is very much more like the old one. The old one is terracotta, terrazzo, marble.
Yeah, and this is a really big space in the inside. I think we need to convey, like, the grandeur of it.
It's huge.
Yeah.
Hugely bigger than a city square. It's the size of a grand Victorian cemetery. You know, it's the size of like Abney Park or Highgate, but entirely a building. I mean, the size is like, you could fit a football stadium on the site without any problems.
Well, it's a colonnade on maybe three or maybe four sides. It slightly varies. And then within it are these series of symbolic structures. There's the big cube, which is for cremated remains. There's a big cone, which is for unidentified remains, or like it's a sort of pauper's grave. And there are these...
It's also, I think it's where they put everything. If you stopped paying your rent, they like put them in the digester.
Oh, really? That's where they go. And, yeah. And then in between these two are this thing which is always shown in plan and looks sort of like a rib cage. These like rectilinear blocks, which gradually get wider and wider and wider as they go down to form a sort of pyramid in form, in plan.
In plan. So it's like a comb. Double-sided comb of sort of in a triangle shape.
Shall we describe what it's like to go to, and then maybe we
well,
can
go
one, through...
Well, there's one thing we haven't said, which is that they only built about half of it, less than half of it. So the there are two sides of the big colonnade, plus a little bit. There is the cube, and that's about it. Yeah. And they sort of finished it off with a blind wall. Yeah.
This is a project we've alluded to, the Rossi's influence as a draftsman and a graphicist, I think, actually maybe we haven't, I can't remember. He does very beautiful drawings, and the drawing by which this one is always represented is the one for the full scheme. So when people visit, I think they often have the experience of wondering where various parts which they've seen represented so many times actually are.
It's very empty, actually, because they haven't built all the bits that go in the middle, with the exception of the cube. So you walk out of the neoclassical and you come into this in-between space, which has got another one of these deep-piered concrete colonnades. Then you walk into that and you look down it, and it's sort of like his apartment block. It's like deep, minimalist detailing concrete. And that's an interesting space that people photograph a lot. Nice play of light and things. Then you go in, and you're in the lower... There are sort of two floors of these sort of filing cabinets of the dead, which actually, these ones actually have a few people in them. A lot of it is quite empty. So you're in the downstairs bit, which is like sort of filing cabinets of the dead, and you can go along there and kind of round and explore those bits. Or you can go upstairs, and upstairs there's another one, and it's underneath this pitched roof. So the walls are very monumental, and there's these concrete stairs and interesting sort of details around that. And then the roof is made of this really thin, crinkly painted metal, yeah, with really small galvanized steel structure. Really light, like really flimsy, and like a flimsy garage roof.
It's a very warehouse vibe. It creates a very strange,
like, with
feeling.
These very, very, like, it's very deliberate. These very, very strong, thick, heavy walls, and this, yeah, very, very flimsy roof.
The materiality is incredibly, well, it is a sort of industrial, sort of utilitarian materiality.
But also, it's really, like, it's not the industrial of sort of, it's like really small steel members, like,
yeah,
80 mil,
yeah,
steel beams.
Like polished concrete floors. All of, yeah, the niches into which the dead go are concrete.
And also, he worked on all the sort of bits of furniture. Like the other place has got its ladders, they've got these huge tip-up buckets for watering the flowers, which are a really strange industrial object, really blank, and strange ladders and things. And these little tiny square windows.
The windows aren't that small, actually. The windows are quite large. The windows, I think, might even be a metre square.
Yeah,
but they read as small from the outside. The strangeness of the building has to do, and this is very deliberate, with this like fusion of these two incompatible types, that there are things about it which seem like an incredibly naive sort of cutesy house, like the little pointy roof, like the little square windows with the little cross sort of mullion in them,
yeah,
like, and also the distribution of the windows. What creates the sense of the uncanny is this overlaying of like incompatible,
yeah,
messages,
and the unbelievable.
And we should say what the other ingredient is, which is this, like, vast scale and these, like, completely austere, unadorned kind of classical features, the colonnades and the...
Yeah, so if you go... Like, we can describe the other elements. In addition to this huge L-shaped, which was meant to be at three sides or four sides, there's the big square in the middle, which is unlike the other side. It's not a graveyard. It's completely blank. It's sort of rectangles of gravel with weeds growing up through them. And in that is a cube, which has square windows.
So it's like a huge cube which has, it's like a 10 by 10 sort of grid of square openings in it.
It's really powerful from the outside, this space. It's a really, these blank walls with their funny, and it's sort of, yeah, like little bits of housiness, and there's cube in the middle which like resonates
the cube,
magnetic
the cube
power.
Is so abstract, and it also has a quality of being extremely ambiguous in terms of scale. So that you, it's very surprising when you get up to it. Like, it's relatively smaller than you expect it to be, and the doorways that you go through at the bottom seem like relatively narrow and not that high compared to what it looked like from far away. Because there's nothing to tell you how big it is. There's like a huge abstract three-dimensional volume with these like abstract holes in it. On the inside, it's got all of these like galvanized metal gantries, and
suddenly it goes into like really, like it's like another joke. It's like it's this mega heavy strong thing on the outside with this really thick geometry, and you go in, and it's got this really galvanized, really thin, skinny like sub scaffolding.
It looks a bit like the set for the TV show Robot Wars.
It's yeah, like, I was thinking like Laser Quest.
Yeah.
It's got this like, because it's like really skinny light and it's completely hollow. It's like a stage set. The exterior monumental space is very powerful, I think.
Yeah.
And the big colonnaded things. The thin steel stuff, I think it's semi-winning me around.
I found it very odd.
But it's extraordinarily strange.
I found it a bit like, it's as if you're in a sort of Amazon warehouse full of dead people. You have like a bit of a sense that someone's going to turn up with a pallet trolley and put someone on it and take them away.
But also, at the same time, it still has these incredibly heavy monumental elements, yeah, which are hugely undermined by this like temporary roof or in the cube, these incredibly thin gantries.
I mean, overall,
it's definitely a subversion. It's definitely about incompletion and like the substantial life and the insubstantial death or something, or some sort of like interrupted destiny. Right, the building has an interrupted destiny. It has bits which are like air.
One of the things which is going on is, when you look at the original drawings for it, there's clearly a kind of bodily metaphor.
Yeah.
You have these kind of medieval drawings where the cathedral plan is also a sort of a plan of the human body. That this the cemetery is very like bodily. There's the cone as a head, and there's this sort of ribcage like central structure.
Yeah, in the big drawing on the front of the book that I'm holding up, which has got all the funny numbers, it is attached to the skull of a ram at the top with the cone as an eye. Admittedly, at the bottom there's a giant lobster, which is labelled with lobster of indeterminate purpose.
Oh no, not indeterminate, ambiguous.
Ambiguous purpose. Ambiguous purpose. Yes, sorry. The giant lobster of ambiguous purpose.
Yeah, it's interesting. So his competition text is I've managed to get it, it's reproduced in oppositions, but it's interesting, he says very distinctly, everything is grey or white, and the texture is like hacked off. It's like sort of rough. But in the final thing, it's smooth and it's all coloured and it reproduces the colours of the cemetery. And maybe this is something that came out of some sort of dialogue with the client or whatever. But it's the last time that he's out of the white period after this. Mm. Like, let me just read the last bit from the competition thing, because I think it says a lot and there's a lot to react to. The cemetery is a public building. Its significance. Together all the buildings read as a city, in which the private relationship with death happens to be the civil relationship with the institution. Thus, the cemetery is also a public building, with an inherent clarity in its circulation and its land use. Externally, it is closed by a fenestrated wall. The elegiac theme does not separate it much from other public buildings. Its order and its location also contain the bureaucratic aspect of death. The project attempts to solve the most important technical issues in the same manner as they are solved when designing a house, a school, or a hotel. As opposed to a house, a school, or a hotel, where life itself modifies the work and its growth in time, the cemetery foresees all modifications. In the cemetery, time possesses a different dimension. Faced with this relationship, architecture can only use its own given elements, refusing any suggestion not born out of its own making. Therefore, the references to the cemetery are also found in the architecture of the cemetery, the house, and the city. The monument is analogous to the relationship between life and buildings in the modern city. The cube is an abandoned or unfinished house. The cone is the chimney of a deserted factory. The analogy with death is possible only when dealing with the finished object. In the end of all things, any relationship other than that of the deserted house and the abandoned work is consequently untransmittable.
I like reading, Rossi, but you have to, like, unbelievably close read everything. Like, as you're reading that, I'm, like, trying to piece a bit together, and then, like, you've moved on to another bit, and I can't, like, I just can't keep up.
He's very clear that these are, like, symbolic archetypes, aren't they? There's, like, a factory chimney. It's a bit sinister. So all the like, poor people get mushed up and put in the base of the factory chimney.
Well, like, everyone does eventually. Like, the way it works is classically, like, you're buried for a few years, then you go in a box, and then you're put in the digester, which I think they probably call it, like, an ossuary. Sorry. But, I mean, the effect is to digest down the bones. The factory thing is extremely strange, because they're always avoiding this. I mean, if you think of... I don't know if you've been to the Venice one, or...
This is the Cemetery Island, isn't it?
Yeah, the Cemetery Island.
I haven't
with
been
the Chipperfield
there.
Project in it. And the old bits as well.
Yeah.
It's quite... You should go.
Yeah.
If you're in there. And the one in Florence is very good too. But normally they're not at all factories. No one wants to be buried in a factory.
No, people shy away from this thing of they're going to be boiled down for glue.
It wants to be like a cenotaph or a sarcophagus.
Yes.
Or like a heavy... The ones in Venice are these huge stones which like cap the pit into which the bones are eventually put.
Oh, I kind of love the, like, nihilism of this, but it doesn't seem very Rossian. It's like, you know...
I mean, I'd happily be buried in there as long as it was convenient for everyone else, but it's a strange thing as a municipal.
It's a strange analogy.
There's a lot of strange analogies. I mean, what are the bureaucratic elements of death that it's dealing with? I don't understand what that's talking about at all.
I think he's alluding to the fact that it's on the edge of the city. I think that's all that he's talking about.
Really?
Yeah.
Is that the bureaucratic element of death?
That's the bureaucratic. Its order and its location also contain the bureaucratic aspect of death. I think that he's thinking about the filing cabinets, maybe, as well.
Yeah, I was thinking about the filing cabinets.
Like, the edge
cabinets.
Of the city. You're taken to the edge of the city and put in a filing cabinet. That's the, like, bureaucracy of death. It's a sort of card catalogue of corpses.
Weird.
It's odd. It's odd.
These are not good metaphors, actually. He's choosing very inappropriate things to talk about old dead granny. We're going to shove him over in a filing cabinet. It's something to say is that it's almost completely empty. No one has chosen to be buried in it, and that's why they didn't bother finishing
People don't like it very much at all.
Architects love it. It's a real, like, yeah, it's full stuffed to the gunnels with, like, architecture students.
Oh, my God, yeah.
Yeah.
He talks about the cemetery as an architectural place, creating a, like, collective memory of and will of the city. But that doesn't seem to be the bureaucratic aspect of death, though. I would say that bureaucracy is somewhat in
Actually, the bureaucratic element of death is really insignificant, something you want to disappear.
Yeah.
Like all the forms and stuff. The purpose of monumental cemeteries is to override that. It is to wash away the bureaucratic aspect.
To kind of solemnise and, like, to make it about this kind of contact with eternity.
Yeah,
heroic memory.
And to remove the sort of realm of... people can be proud of their work or what they do, but it's not like the collection of the dead, the honouring of the ancestors is not ultimately about that. It's actually about something else.
It's not about, like, the numbering of the filing cabinet slots.
Yeah. The filing cabinets is nice because it puts you within the community, not because it's bureaucratic. It's nice because everyone is there in the city together, which is a funny thing. He doesn't talk about community. In general, he is much more interested in the interrupted individual than actually into the communal.
Yes, the whole project is in so many ways a metaphor for Rossi and for his ideas and for his project. So it's unfinished. It's entered in this very sort of surprising and slightly, like, accidental-seeming way. My experience of trying to find it, you go in the side of this building, which is not the one you were looking for. You enter into this like amazing space, which you're trying to find a way through. You walk all the
way
through.
To get out of this incredibly beautiful.
Yeah, you walk all the way through it, through this whole graveyard. You then have to go down into the basement, then back up some other stairs
through
the other side.
Out of a corner.
Yeah, yeah, through the
And then you get into a space which is almost exactly the same as the one that you came into in the first place of the first building.
Yeah, and then you enter it, and then you discover that it's like a fragment of the building that you'd ever seen illustrated, and the rest of it would not been built. So there's this curious, there's a lot of bathos if you have a taste for that kind of thing.
I sort of had an awareness that it hadn't.
But even the fact that it hasn't been finished is not, like, even without that, I think that there's a real, there's a really sort of strange
experience. I find the way they've dealt with the edge very interesting. I was very attracted to the unbuilt edge, which is that there's this wall with blind windows in it, which is like a single-story tall, which demarks the edge of the site. It's very Rossian. And then beyond that, there's greenery and these galvanised stainless steel lampposts of the dual carriageway, which sort of like are highly articulated and are exactly the language of the galvanised steel. Galvanised steel is one of the big materials. The big materials of this are concrete, like render, galvanized steel and gravel with like grass growing through it, and they are the materials, with the exception of the polished concrete, of Italian suburbia. Like all these things, this one is the one that is most laden with metaphors. He talks about it as a board game, and in fact he says he thought of a board game and then he thought of the cemetery. It's very worth going to. It's really good, I thought. How do you rate it?
It's an extraordinary space and series of elements. I thought it was a failure.
Do you think any of his buildings were a success?
No. He said there's this famous quotation which you might as well have, which is that the what he calls in the competition the sanctuary, which is sometimes called the columbarium, the cube basically, is so let's well he has this little quotation about it. The cubic volume with its regular windows has the appearance of a house with no floors and no roof. The windows, which cut directly into the wall, have no frames or panes. This is the house of the dead, and in terms of architecture, it is unfinished and abandoned, and therefore analogous to death. That's how we're meant to read all of this. This, like, everything in this is an analogy for death, which for Rossi is, you know, the unfinished building, the building which will never be finished, is this kind of poignant metaphor for
but he
the
didn't
unfinished
mean it's
human
unfinished.
Life.
I also think, although it's not a very poetic quote, and it's in the book, but the one about like the architect who cares most about the drawings and less about the building is happiest, is because actually a lot of the like the stainless steel thing, the galvanized steel thing, that feels like an incidental decision that had like really striking and strange consequences to me. I think we can read too much into it. I think it actually is just like sort of a mistake.
I think so. This is one of these projects which is, I had honestly never seen the interior of it until I went there. And I think there are very few photos on the internet of the interior. And the interiors are very, very strange.
I'll tell you something. The internet is incredibly loyal to Rossi, isn't it? Like with its picture selection, it's always taking the nice one. And it's never taking the like weird, ungainly, like junky one, which is kind of just as obvious.
They are very peculiar spaces. I think almost my favourite part is the interiors.
Oh, yeah.
They're so unlike anything I've ever seen before.
Actually, I think the interior, not of the cube, but the top bit of, whatever we call it, the wall.
Yeah,
really,
of the sort of main corpse storage.
It's really extraordinary.
Because they're these like endless corridors full of the dead in these like concrete honeycombs.
But with all these strange moments, and there's lots of moments. Yeah. Like the way the staircases work is peculiar. I love all the weird bits of furniture. I know I've mentioned it. All the weird, like, water, which he designed and are very strange. The, like, glimpses, the sort of framed glimpses through to this, which are like paintings on the wall, is weird. I loved it.
I'm very glad for having been. I think it's one of the most extraordinary things I've seen. I think. It's hard.
I think it was a real highlight of that trip, actually.
Yeah.
It was like a real...
It's unlike anything seen before or since. Highly enjoyable for architects, should we put it that way?
Yeah. Did you feel that it helped you contact oceanic emotions. Alex cried.
Did he?
Yeah, he cried at the beauty of it.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, he cried. I don't know if that's something we're allowed to put out.
We should 100% put that out.
I think he listens. I think he listens to the show.
This is one of these real, like, failed transcendence moments, isn't it? It's like,
transcendence can only ever be a failure if that's what it's set up to be.
Yeah, but like, it's sort of spectacularly failed. Okay, you've got to go. It's sort of slightly in the middle of nowhere and you probably need to get a bike.
Modena's got an unbelievably beautiful cathedral. It's great food. You can get some balsamic vinegar. That's where that comes from.
Yeah.
There's Mantua just up the road. You can look at all the things built by...
You'll have a good time.
Emilia Romagna.
Yeah, if you're in...
What's he called? That's the name of the area.
Giulio Romano.
Giulio Romano.
Giulio Romano, yeah.
There's the fantastic Sala Giganti. Yeah. There's loads of stuff around there.
There's a sort of not very interesting building by Alberti. There's all kinds of stuff.
There's the weird church with the triangles.
Guys, you just got to come, you know, if you're in Peru or New Zealand or whatever. Just fly straight to Modena for a couple of days and then go home.
Hi friends, it's Luke. I'm editing this show at the moment. We recorded this all as a single episode, but it's only halfway and we're already at an hour. So I'm going to put this out as a single episode and we'll have the remainder of Aldo Rossi's buildings, the theatre at Venice... his contribution to the birth of postmodernism as a style and various late and peculiar works as a separate episode later. Remember, you can get in touch with the show by email at aboutbuildingsandcities@gmail.com. Thanks a lot to people who've already emailed, and we're going to be addressing some of these in a future show. Thanks a lot. Bye.